Thank you very much for coming back. So let's just take a moment to close our eyes and just reestablish, just check in with your motivation. And as we have not died yet, we have yet another day to glean the meaning of this precious life we have, and to use it as wisely and skillfully as possible, to be kind and caring to ourselves as well as others, and to try as much as we can to practice in a way that will move us on this path to full awakening, to becoming a Buddha, as then we're able to help all living beings, please relax. Open your eyes. Bless you. Did you see it with your sneeze? Good. That's where it starts. Fantastic. A little review. Let's see what went in. Okay. Patty's ready. She's like, okay, I got it. Okay. Without looking at your notes. Okay. 9-point death meditation. What do you remember? How do you divide it up? 9-point death meditation.
Three roots.
Thank you.
Death.
What's under the three roots?
Three
reasonings. Okay. That lead you to?
Three resolutions.
Thank you. Three resolutions. Okay. Number one root.
That's a certain.
Number two root. Time of death is uncertain. Number three. Accept Dharma. Okay, great. For death is certain, what are the three reasonings?
Everyone dies.
Time of death, you're a moment closer. You're always a moment closer to death. Number three. Yes, very little time to practice. Thank you. Second, and this leads you to a resolution of what?
I must practice.
Okay, must practice Dharma. Second root, time of death is uncertain. Number one, reasoning? People die at all different ages, right? Okay, now all of you that are answering, I want you to be quiet, and we're going to ask the people who aren't answering. What do you remember? Okay, number two root, under the time of death is uncertain.
More things supporting death.
Thank you. More things supporting death than supporting life. Number three. Anybody remember?
Body's fragile.
Thank you. Body's fragile. And under the only thing that benefits you at the death time is, and sorry, the resolution for the time of death is uncertain. I must practice now is the key, now. Okay, number three. Only thing benefits you at the death time is your Dharma practice. Number one, reasoning?
Not your wealth?
Wealth? Possessions and wealth, yep, absolutely. No, family and friends, number two. Number three? Not your body. Thank you. Not your body leads you to a resolution. I must practice Dharma now, and I must practice well. Thank you. You guys are awesome. Thank you. Okay, now that I think we're all here, meditation, okay? Now, there's different meditations on death, as I mentioned. The easiest one, I said, is lighter level, wake up in the morning. Not that it's light, but you're not, you know, doing such a heavy meditation. Intensive is, today is my last day, okay? Another level of death meditation is the 9-point death meditation. We did the beginning part of that. Another death meditation we don't have time to do in here right now, I usually do it on retreat with people in a death retreat, is meditating on your own death. Meditating on your own death. Usually, it is on my website. It takes about 45 minutes minimal to really do it properly. And you can even lie down doing it, because people have trouble sitting up, and the problem is people fall asleep. But it's very effective to visualize and take yourself through as if you have discovered a lump in your neck. And the whole process of going to the doctor, and how in the very beginning phases you're kind of in denial, and but you keep checking your neck. You know how you had things like this, and is it something, do I need to go to the doctor, you know, and all the things the mind goes through, and waiting in the doctor's offices for this, and then they see, and then you need a biopsy, and then they talk about this, and then finally you get a cancer diagnosis, and then they talk about treatment, and then they realize that it's all throughout your body, and you have like 6 months. So and you're kind of going through stages in the meditation, imagining, you're rehearsing. So in some ways, it sounds intense, and it can be an intense meditation, but if you rehearse it a few times now, it's going to happen to some people like that. You're not creating your death. You're not giving yourself cancer. But if those things do happen, which happen to a lot of people, I practice this a little bit. You know, now it's different when it is real, but still, you thought about it. You've reflected a little bit. So it can be quite hard for people, but you do that. So what I'd like to do is we're going to pick up at the end of that meditation, because it doesn't leave you bleak, though. It doesn't leave you bleak, because what we talked about yesterday is the mind, in its most subtle form, goes on. You will have other experiences, other adventures, other lives. Okay? Let's just sit comfortably. Find that comfortable meditation posture if you can. Try your best. Well, let me find my little note here. Just close your eyes lightly. And we also will have a break in this session a little later. But slowly allow your awareness to settle on your breath and just let your mind settle here in the space. Just a normal breath. We're having a normal death now. And various things will often pull our energy away from what we're concentrating on. You just become aware when the mind wanders. You don't need any additional judgment or story. And just bring the mind back to whatever we're focusing on. Imagine you are lying in a bed at the end of your life. Everything is done now. You do not have to engage in any activity anymore. You're actually too weak to do so. but you've been able to do some practice in this life. You took care of your business as well as you could. And now you are actively dying. So let go of all the concerns. Should have, could have, would have. There is nothing more you can do at this point but relax. The breathing becomes very thin, and there is much more now of an exhalation than an inhalation. And the gross wind of your respiration becomes more subtle and more subtle. And imagine there's one more exhalation. And the gross breathing ceases. You have an opportunity now to become aware and to concentrate on more subtle visions that will automatically arise to your consciousness. The mind is continuing, and the earth element begins to dissolve. So the body becomes very thin. The limbs are loose. You may have a sense of the body sinking into the earth. Your sight is unclear, if there's any ability at all. Most probably you're unable to open or close eyes at this point. The luster of your body is changing because this form aggregate is dissolving. And what appears to your mind is a mirage-like image. A mirage-like image. As if you look out on a hot asphalt in the summer and you see shimmering waves of water, an appearance of water. This is your whole experience. This is your mind right now. You're not separate from the mirage. Concentrate as best as you can on the mirage-like image. The second dissolution is the water element begins to dissolve. The fluids of your body begin to dry up, such as saliva and sweat and urine, the blood, and the blood may coagulate in the bottom parts of your body due to gravity. The aggregate of feeling, which is pain, pleasure, or neutral feeling, begins to dissolve. So you no longer experience those in any external way. Sounds may be degenerating, and what appears to your consciousness is a smoke-like vision, like a blue-gray, like you're in a room filled with this blue-gray smoke, and this is your entire experience. It is not separate from your mind. Concentrate on this smoke-like vision as best as you can, and just think in the back of your mind, I must not miss the clear light. I must not miss the clear light. Third dissolution, the fire element begins to dissolve. So the heat begins to leave the body, from the top of the body, coming down to the heart. From the lower part, lower extremities, coming up to the heart. Aggregate of discrimination dissolves. So you're no longer... You would no longer recognize people if you're still in a stage of slight breathing. And if the inhalation is still happening, it's extremely weak. Sometimes these visions happen when there's bare, just light, still breath happening. Smell is gone at this point. And the internal vision is like fireflies in the night sky, or massive sparks over a radiant fire. So spark-like vision is what appears to your consciousness. And this is your whole experience. You're not separate from this, as if you're looking out at it separate. This is your mind. Concentrate on this. And the fourth, grosser dissolution occurs, the wind element supporting your body dissolves. So at this point is when the final exhalation would happen, finally, if it has not already happened. The tongue becomes thick and short. Taste goes. The aggregate of compositional factors dissolves, like memories, ideas of love and hate, experiences of that all dissolve. And you have an appearance to your mind, internally, of the glow around the flickering butter lamp or candle that's about to go out. Merge your mind with this as much as possible. Just thinking with one corner of the mind, I must not miss the clear light. And now the subtle consciousness begins dissolving. Subtle winds. So as the 80 different conceptions your mind begin dissolving, the winds in the right and left channels above the heart begin to come down from the top of the head to the heart. And the sign that you have is a white appearance, like a full moon, that you see like a big harvest moon over an empty field. Just focus on this. This is your entire experience. White appearance. And the next disillusion, there is a red appearance, like a magenta, red, brilliant red sunset. As the winds in the right and left channels below the heart begin to enter the central channel at the base of the spine and begin their ascent to the heart. They're not in the heart yet, but they begin moving up and you have this red increase, brilliant orange magenta sunset. Focus your mind on that. That's your whole experience. And as this dissolves, the upper and lower winds begin to gather at the heart, entering the drop, indestructible drop, in the center of the heart chakra. And there is a black near attainment. A black near attainment, because you're nearly at the clear light, the mind in its most subtle experience. Black as black can be. Focus on this. And then the clear light dawns as all the winds dissolve into the very subtle life-bearing wind in the indestructible drop at the heart. This is the purest, most radiant luminosity you can imagine. Focus your mind on this as best as you can. And as you focus on this, whatever notion of yourself arises, yourself, the I, a very dominant, independent experience of yourself, if that arises, analyze for a moment, how does that I exist? Whatever understanding you have of emptiness, please meditate on that here. The independent notion, concretely existing I, that we cart around with us every moment, that doesn't exist at all. That I does not exist at all. It's a complete hallucination. So whatever understanding you have, thinking of the clear light, merging your mind with that, completely empty in nature. Absent of any inherent, independent, concretely existing experience. Slowly bring yourself back here into the room. Please relax and slowly open your eyes. So I just wanted to take you through that briefly, but it's good to go through it slowly, and it is related to some tantric practice we do. It's in all the highest yoga tantra sadhanas, the practices, And but it's okay. I think it's okay to do some of the visions to get used to it. More powerful when you have a tantric initiation. But these visions are going to show up. Again, they show up when you fall asleep, when you have a big sneeze or a big yawn, sexual orgasm, and they'll show up when you're dying. And the more we can familiarize our mind with them, then you may be able to catch the visions at the death time to recognize the clear light. The mind, in its most subtle experience, to meditate on emptiness there. Why? So you can actualize more highly realized states. Everybody understand? Slowly? So it's very powerful. So I just wanted to do that at some point. So when you die, this is what's going to happen. There's more happening. This will go on. And when the clear light ceases, you go into a bardo, in an in-between state, as I mentioned yesterday. And then in a more subtle bardo body, it's a more subtle body than this body, and you're going to be uncontrollably looking for the condition that sets up your next rebirth. Till 49 days when you absolutely will combine with that condition to start developing in the next form, next life, like that. Yes.
So to be clear, when we go into the bardo, the very subtle wind and very subtle mind, where are they?
So they would be located in a sense, in whatever structure that bardo being's body would have, which is more subtle than ours. I don't know exactly what it looks like, but
right.
Something that could traverse through walls, they say, and it would be in a subtle energy system in that.
Okay.
Contained in that.
Okay, so it is contained within the bardo body, whatever
I believe
form
so.
That takes.
I believe so.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, thank you.
So I just want to give you, that's one aspect. And so let's go on with how else do I get myself ready. And I want to talk about from one of an old favorite on my reading list, and I realize it's great that the library and the bookstore you have, the death book area, I thought had a lot of different death books, but it's more just the red book that you're trying to sell. Is that right? Because let me give you some other books that somebody asked me about. There's a book called Death, Intermediate State, and Rebirth. And what's probably helpful is this is on my reading list, so if I email it to Donna, then it's easier. But Death, Intermediate State, and Rebirth by Lati Rinpoche, who is an incredible being who passed away, but I think his reincarnation has been found. He's an amazing being. Was an older book that really gives you some more technical details of what's going on. A very helpful book I read a long time ago. I could read it again. And so there's a lot of useful books on there, and you're probably, I didn't really get a chance yet to look at all the bookstore in the library. I'm sure you have a lot of these books here. It's really helpful. Like that. Yes. Liz says yes. Great. You've got that one. Perfect. Wonderful. In the library. Fantastic. So nice. They have a nice library here. So another book I loved, an old favorite of a different type, a different ilk, is called Facing Death and Finding Hope. Facing Death and Finding Hope by Christine Longacre. So she is a student of Sylvia Rinpoche. I met her many years ago. She wrote the book a long time ago about her husband's last year when he was diagnosed with leukemia years ago, in a time they didn't have many treatments. And also, as some of you are aware of, I'm going to say 20, 30 years ago and longer ago, but hospitals weren't that skilled in how to tell you that somebody has a terminal diagnosis. And they weren't really all that skillful how they would deliver the news. And she talks about a very unfortunate circumstance. Her young husband, they're married a year or whatever, just married, and he gets this diagnosis and the way it's delivered to them and how mishandled the whole thing is until he dies a year later. And so she has some great stuff in here. And what she has in here are the four tasks of living and dying, and this is how we get ourselves ready. This is really useful. In fact, it's interesting, as I pulled this out a long time ago, so Venerable Sangye Khadro, when she put the book together from FPMT of Wholesome Fear with Lama Zopa Rinpoche, there's a book they asked her to make that course, the organization, like when they asked me to make Buddhism in a Nutshell, Wholesome Fear, and she has these in there as well. Like, it's useful. This is useful, practical stuff. Four tasks of living and dying, and here they are. Number one, task of living, something you can think about. Am I doing these things right now? The first one is understanding and transforming suffering. Understanding and transforming suffering. So this involves coming to accept that suffering and problems are a natural, inevitable part of life and learning ways of coping better with problems. So first we start with smaller problems. And how are you doing with larger problems? Okay. Especially a big issue can be when I'm dying, okay, or I'm losing a loved one or something like that. So understanding and transforming suffering. This relates to when we first started talking about impermanence. How are you with change? But to take it a little step further, how are you with suffering? How's it going? It's tricky, right? It is tricky. It's so interesting. I mean, some people are really flow through. You know, I worked with this young woman. She lives in San Diego now. She was one of the best retreat cooks I've ever worked with in my life. To be so mature at 23 years old, whatever. She lost her mom when she was like 24, very young, and her mom died and a lot of problems in her life. And she never complained, ever. She never complained. You know, it was amazing. Just every morning, you know, I'd see her in the kitchen. How's it going? Great. That was her response. I learned that from her. I learned, great, you know, and really great. Not just, like sometimes you're forcing it, but I really, there's times because I was raised in a different environment and, not faulting anyone, people that were incredibly critical and negative, three people in my life. And so it becomes a habit, and you just learn to whine and complain. That's how you get through life. We have a Jewish expression, right? This isn't a Jewish expression, but do you know the Yiddish word kvetch? Like complain? I kvetch, therefore I am, right? That's kind of how I was raised, okay? So I thought that was a norm, that you just voice your opinion negatively, you know, doesn't, and we're all spoiled anyway, so it's like, wah, wah. And then I met this woman, but I've been working on it for years. But I was really amazed. I was really like, you know, great is always available to you if you choose it. But there's a lot of people that choose suffering. Don't we know people that choose suffering? I know several of them. They wake up every morning, and that's the path they pick. So it's different to accept problems. Like, Rinpoche is very much into getting us to welcome problems. That's different, okay? But there's people that are continually finding some kind of negative little twist over and over. So it's really helpful that you can really transform this mind. And I started very much watching my mind that would be, like, I see the little negative things there swimming around. You know, when somebody would say to me, hi, did you sleep well last night? And I could be like, you know, and then I'm like, yeah, I did. Everything's fine, you know, it's great. Why? Because I appreciated my life when I woke up in the morning. It's amazing. There's so much amazing good. Why am I going to focus? So you work on it. It's a process. You work on it. So understanding and transforming suffering. And again, this thing, problems are natural. These are my notes. Problems are a natural, inevitable part of life. Problems are inevitable, a natural, inevitable part of life. This is samsara. That's its nature, problems and suffering. That's its nature. There's some people that rail against it every moment, don't accept. They don't accept. We know people like this, right? Continual problem. I mentioned in here before, years ago, but years ago I was on a train in India, an overnight train, long journey, like 12 hours, and my compartment and my six compatriots four Indians, me, and an English woman. I didn't know her, but we're in the compartments and overnight, and she was miserable. She was just miserable. Just a continual, you know, and I was watching in the beginning. It was really like I thought, oh, she's having a hard time. But it went on and on and on. Everything was a problem. And I could see the Indian people. They knew a little English. And then I thought kind of sometimes in the compartment, it's nice to have a Westerner there with me. The Indians are really lovely, though. But then she was so miserable that I'm like, it's not so nice to have her here with me. But I could see they were also challenged, seeing. And then I get embarrassed. Like, here's a Westerner that is not living in an undeveloped country with, you know, and there, and she's just, it went on and on. It was really interesting for me to watch my mind of, you know, it's my mind giving me a little mirror. So it's so interesting. She just, everything. I was just amazed. So in the morning on the trains, they take your order for breakfast and tea or coffee. I love that. You know, I was just on a train the other day. You got to go to the dining car. You're like, you got to get up from your seat, walk in the dining car. And then on a lot of American trains, the food isn't, if they have a dining car, it could be better, but the little cafe things they have, you know, it's a bunch of packaged stuff. So they serve you. They have a kitchen. They make you hot, you know, an omelet. You can get a veg omelet and you can get all kinds of food, cooked food, hot cooked food. And then they bring you, a little thermos. Little plastic thermos of tea or coffee. Sweet milk tea or coffee. Like the way my grandmother used to make coffee for me, right? Little plastic thermos. It's so adorable. It's like some little thing I had when I was in first grade. Plastic thing. You know, they don't make them anymore in the States, really. So they bring it and they deliver it right to your seat. They take the order and they come back a half an hour later. You know, great. So I was trying to get her. I said, isn't it great how they take your order and they deliver the food to you? She goes, yeah, you know. The food is dirty. Anyway, the momlet comes. Her omelet is cold. Her coffee's cold. I said, isn't it cute, the little thermos? You know. And then, and it was so amazing. And you see the emptiness of the whole thing. But she, so then the sun was rising out the window. It's so beautiful in the Indian trains, looking out into the, you know, the vistas and the water buffalo. Sometimes there's a little village, and sometimes there's hills, and little water, and the water buffaloes, and the little villages, thatch roofs, and people caca in the fields. You see everything there happening. It's just, it's really magical, the villages now, not the city so much. But so we looked out, and the sun was rising, and I see, and the Indian people and I had been getting along, and I see, and we're all looking at the sun, and they're smiling at me, and I'm smiling at them, and just, you're having a moment, you know, and it's so beautiful that I thought, this will get her. You know, this is beautiful. This is, you can't say anything negative about this. It's such a really rich experience. And she's looking down in her bag about something. And I said, the sun is rising. You know, look at the sun, right? So she turns to the window. She literally looks for a while. You know, and I thought, she looks and. And she says to me, are you ready for this? She says, the window is full of scratches. Right? So for me, this really transformed my mind, it really changed my mind a lot, is you have a choice in life every day. And you can wake up and see scratches, that the wind is full of scratches. Every moment you choose, or you can see in a magnificent sunrise. You can see something glorious, or you can see something really dreadful. It's really perspective and what your mind is familiar with and what you're interested in putting out there in the world. So it really taught me a big lesson because it was really a mirror. I felt like it was a mirror for my mind, like all the whining and, you know. So here's number two, four tasks of living and dying. And I've been talking about this as well. Making a connection, healing relationships, and letting go. We'll take a break in about 15 minutes. Making a connection, healing relationships, and letting go. So this is about communicating openly, compassionately, skillfully with all the people in your lives, especially those closest to us. Okay, and can you clear up any unresolved situations? How's that going for you? Going well, yeah. So we try. And I do know people actively dying when they, they were hanging on, and we, you know, and I would sometimes just ask one more time, and I'm like, is there anybody else you want to talk to? You know, and they'll come up with something. You know, my brother, I haven't talked to my brother in 5 years, right? You know, all of a sudden it'll pop up later. Better to do it now, because sometimes the person's too weak, they can't speak on the phone anymore, they're having trouble breathing, they're not clear. Better to sort those things now. You'll be so much more peaceful when you die. So much more peaceful. The other thing is, don't have expectations. If you had a big fight with a family person, you haven't spoken to them in 5 years or 10 years, right? At least you make the gesture. And you try to find them and try to call and try to communicate or send a letter, however you choose to do, right? And if they don't want to talk to you, that's their business. Let it go. But you made the effort. You know, and you don't need the person physically in front of you to ask forgiveness, to forgive them, to make your peace. It will change energy. So I had somebody in my life that cut me out of their life for 10 years, an old friend, an old boyfriend. We had a terrible breakup, right? And he wouldn't speak to me for 10 years. And he sent letters back unopened. Like, you know, so we were just cut off, and it was really painful. And I would ask through friends how he was doing. He lived in another country, and I would, you know, and I just kind of let it go. But it was still, it wasn't okay for me here. So finally I realized I couldn't communicate, so I just did a meditation several times, and I put him in front of me in a meditation over and over. I did it for a while, for a few weeks maybe. Maybe not every day, but I did it for a few weeks, and I just kind of said everything I needed to say in a very calm, gentle way. And I imagined what he would say to me. And I listened, tried to listen really intently, right? And I'd say again, and I'd ask his forgiveness. And I'd tell him I forgave him. And, you know, over and over I had to do it until I actually felt done. I felt like it's the best I could do. I feel like I finished that. And I let it go. And then I think he had, like, some milestone birthday, you know, shortly coming up, of like 40 or something like that. And I got an address, decided to send him a card, and it would then email started, because this was long before email. And so I just put my email, and I said, I just had to send you a happy birthday. Just wanted to, hadn't had any contact with him in like 12 years. And I put my email, I just said, just really want to wish you a happy birthday. And I got an email, you know, back in like a week. You know, immediately responded how great, how happy he was to hear from me. And he's one of my best friends today. So, and I really think the work I did, it changes the karma. Something shifted like that. And sometimes time heals. But it's really nice from your side. Make the gesture. Try to finish, you know, because I knew that was something I wasn't going to be wearing when I was dying. I was like, I'm done. I completed that well. I completed it well. The issue is completing it well, not just completing it. You know, you slam the door. Get out of my life, jerk. No, you want to do it well. You need to do it well. Because otherwise it'll come back up. But even from this moment on, another thing is, how am I communicating now? So the more skillful we get now, then less things to resolve later. If my communication's getting clearer, I'm a little bit more compassionate in the space, trying to live authentically, that can be really helpful. Number three, we've been talking about cultivating a spiritual practice. You gotta have it, because that's what's gonna be there for you. That's your safety net. That's your safety net. That will sustain you. And some people, it's amazing. There was somebody that was dying, another teacher I had. They were across the country, but somebody phoned the teacher. This was years ago, and somebody phoned the teacher to say that he's dying. Can I put the phone to his ear? He just wants you to go over one more time the Tonglen meditation. So the teacher explained it to him again. He couldn't really speak very well. And they heard it again. And he basically said to the person that had called for him, he was like, okay, got it. I'm set. Got it. I'm ready to go. Got it. Like, that's a great space to be in. You're ready. Got your seatbelt on. Ready for the ride. I'm all set. Okay, number four, finding meaning in life. Finding meaning in life. This is really important. I talk about this a lot in classes. Please find meaning in your life now. don't wait any longer if you haven't found it. And what I mean by that is, what lights you up inside, and it lends to your substantial, deep contentment. I'm not talking about superficial happiness. I'm talking about deep contentment. When you know you're in sync with the universe, you just feel like, now we may not have it every moment of every day, but you're on a path and you're kind of, you know, this is working, this is going well. And and for me, a lot of it is contributing to helping others, doing something in my life that I'm helping others. But then it's, how will I do that? And I'm also involved in that. So the self-compassion aspect is big as well. I need to make sure that I've got a balanced mind and a relatively healthy body, and that I'm leading a balanced life, and that I'm being good to myself, because that's where all that meaning is going to come from, of my serving others. Otherwise, it'll either be superficial, it'll collapse quickly, I'll be resentful, whatever, things like that. So an example I've given before in here was when I was at Vajrapani Institute many years ago. We were just talking about that. And we held a retreat in 1997, most secret Hayagriva retreat with Lama Zopa Rinpoche, and we had 80 people come from around the world for 3.5 weeks at the center. It was a lot to hold at the time. You know, I had been the director about a couple years by then, and the staff was relatively new. It was our first big retreat together, and, you know, we were nervous and things. So we were doing it, but I used to think, when I was really, really happy, you know, what really lit me up, I used to think, before this, was I love beach holidays. That was my meaning in life. Because I wanted to set myself up so that I could make sure that I had a lot of beach holidays. That was going to do it for me. That was meaning. Now, I've had beach holidays, and I would have beach holidays, and one of them went on for like 2 or 3 weeks once, after some retreat period, and I ended up trying to, you know, I was re-entering the States after a few years, so I wanted to kind of have a break. And it was okay, you know, and then I read my whole stack of books, and then I was like, you know, now what? And, but it got boring. And I wasn't really doing any volunteer work, and I wasn't really, you know, and after a while I was like, this is it? It's just about me? And, you know, my own gratification? Like, it's really empty, really not much meaning, that kind of empty. So then I'm at Vajrapani now, fast forward many years. I'm at Vajrapani hosting this retreat. I wasn't a nun then, I was a lay person. But we're in the middle of the retreat, a couple weeks in. It's going really, really well. It's going really well. And Donna, you know that feeling, or Jill. You know, you're light of the path, and everybody's set, and you fielded all the complaints now, and everybody's trying to settle down. Everybody has their thing about the food and this, and there's no protein, and and everybody has their, you know how we are, and this, and I like my seat, and you know, whatever it is, my room and the bed, and okay. Then it settles down, and then it starts running itself like a well-oiled machine, and everybody's in the golf, and all of a sudden, you know, you have a moment, and you go, this is amazing. So it was running really well. Everybody was happy. Rinpoche, the staff was happy. The retreaters were happy. Going so well. And one night we came outside, me and some of my closest friends there, walking around our stupa. And it was night, and the redwood trees and the lights, and I thought, I am just higher than I've ever been. I thought, this is what lends meaning to my life. This is what I want to do. This really makes me deeply content in here, and I just want to direct my life to doing more of this. More of this. As much as I could, like that. So please find that meaning of what is the thing where you know you're exactly in the right place. That can be really, really helpful. And find it now. Don't wait. And you might have to experiment a little bit and try different things and figure out what keeps you off balance, what keeps you from your practice. That's another great question to ask yourself. You know? And then try to ask other people. And sometimes you just need to visualize taking a crowbar under your butt and, you know, just get down to it and do it. Just start sitting. And so those are the four tasks of living and dying. Let's see, where are we? Okay. Okay, let me add in. I'm going to start moving into some practical things. And let me just see if there's one thing here I want to say. Yeah, Death Intermediate State and Rebirth by Lati Rinpoche and Jeffrey Hopkins. That was a book I used to use a lot. Death Intermediate State and Rebirth by Lati Rinpoche and Jeffrey Hopkins. So another thing that practically as we move into this phases is when you think about it, when I lead the meditation on your own death, there's a part near the end before the dissolutions, because I always add the dissolutions in, that you're not just dying. And there's a part where you need to say goodbye to people. This is the hardest part of the meditation. You know, you're dying and you've had times where you are now, I'll ask people to take themselves on their last walk. So you imagine, you know, and think about what that's like. You may have been with people where, I had a friend once, she's just like, this is my last meal. You know, her body wasn't functioning for her to eat anymore. And she looked at me, she said, I just can't believe I'm not going to eat anymore. I'm not going to eat again. You know, it's painful to be with that. Painful, you know, so like you can envision these things. But something I also like to do is when I say goodbye to people, I like to try to have the presence of mind. And sometimes we're flying around and we forget that, you know, goodbye. Because I don't know if I'll see them again. I don't know. Now, we do that with old people. You say goodbye with old people. And I used to, when I'd leave my grandmother, I'd think, and I'd fly back to California, and I would just think, I don't know if I'm going to see her, but you don't know with anybody if you'll see them again. Many times we've lost somebody. So it's nice to be present with that. It keeps that death and impermanence thing quite clear in my mind like that. Let me just make sure I've got everything. Okay. So let me talk a little bit about karma, and then we'll take a short break. I also want to bring up right now materials. So there is this wonderful book we've talked about, the red book for sale here, How to Enjoy Death, Preparing to Meet Life's Final Challenge Without Fear, that has all the practices and things. And it combined a lot of things, but there's also a booklet I really liked. I don't know if I have it here. I think these are all combined, How to Help the Dying and the Dead. I think it's all part of that book now. But there's also, Rinpoche had a booklet. I don't think I brought it this time. But what it includes is how to combine an entire life's practice into the five powers. Let me just double check if it's in here, because it probably is. Into the five powers. Yeah, it's in here. Everything's in here now. It's perfect. Okay. The best way to live and die. This is the best way to live and die. Lama Zopa Rinpoche. Practice the five powers. Okay, let's explore the five powers. People always say to me, I need to know what to do. What should I do? Think about it. This is your life. This is your practice. Okay. Now, one of them, the five powers in life are intention, training. They'll call it the white seed. I don't really like that. I find it racist, so I'm going to call it the virtuous seed. Blaming the ego and prayer. These are the five powers at the time of death. And this is kind of related to the seven-point mind training, which is a Lojong text. Seven-point mind training. Lojong, lo is mind, jong, training. The Mahayana instruction for transferring consciousness is only the five powers. This is a quote. So the five powers is, there's one for living, but this is one at the time of death, Rinpoche specifies. Page 29. Great. And so, and what Rinpoche says is the reason it's different is the order of them at the death time to practice for death is different. Okay. So what Rinpoche is saying is for death, he starts with what's called the power of the white seed. The power of the white seed. And again, I'm not comfortable with white seed, but I'm going to say it's like a power of accumulating positive conditions, accumulating merit. Okay, so that's what this is about, accumulating merit, the power of the seed. What are you doing to create the causes and conditions for you to have a great life, that you can practice Dharma, you have every perfect condition to practice Dharma, meaning you're healthy, you have a sound mind, your family's cool with it, you have enough financial resources, and on and on and on. We have to create that to happen. It doesn't just happen. The fact that you're sitting in this room right now and you're attached, connected to Kadampa Center is your mind stream and all the beings in your past, in this life and past lives made incredible efforts to make positive imprints in your mind. Okay? So I really appreciate all the beings in my past lives that must have done incredible, extraordinary effort to get me here. Of the kind of life I've had right now. Am I continuing to accumulate good conditions now while I have these opportunities? And you can read more about this. Page 31, Rinpoche goes into the details about power of the white seed. And partly one of the things he talks about is give away all your possessions before you die. And one thing is, like when I mention the Geshe that I saw and he only had the robe left and the ritual, it's ease for the mind. Now, again, you don't maybe not want to give them all away right now if you're using them, but I know a couple in New York, close friends of mine. They have a small, I always call it a little Zen nest, their apartment, a basement apartment in New York they've rented for years. There's two of them. He is now 80 or 81. She's in her 70s. And they're slowly getting rid of. You know, they live very simply. I'm so impressed how they live. And they're slowly, and each time I come and stay in their apartment, there's stuff that I can see has moved out. And they'll say, yeah, we've just given that to his son, they still have what they need to live, but they've kind of looked around and there's some extraneous stuff. And then each year they kind of, I know people that every time they buy a new sweatshirt, an old sweatshirt goes out. They've got enough. So it's something you can think about. There is, there's a couple different terms in here. The power of planning. Oh, I see. Power of, okay. So then Rinpoche adds the next one, power of intention. And Rinpoche's added planning. The power of planning is the same. Power of planning. So what do we mean by this? Power of intention or planning. It's a power of motivation. It's your attitude. Okay? So, and Rinpoche's whole thing, in this case, remember bodhicitta. How much am I soaking my mind in that attitude, that motivation? That's my planning. So that's what arises at that time. Number three, the power of blaming the ego. Give up self-cherishing at the time of death. That's what that's about, the power of blaming the ego. In the famous, if you study Lojong, mind training, the famous mind training slogans that are, you can read them in several books. One that happens to pop into my mind now is Venerable Pema Chodron, Places That Scare You. Has anyone read that book? The Places That Scare You. It's a great book. And it's all about the mind training slogans. Okay? And what they say is one of the famous slogans is, put all the blame on one. Put all the blame on one. Look at our culture. You know. I grew up in a house. Whose fault is it? Who broke the... Okay, you find out who broke it. Did they do it intentionally? Usually not. Now you know who did it. Now what? What do you want to do? Punish them. Get revenge. You know, it's hard. This is the way, you know, I look at what goes on in the Middle East, right? You know, somebody lobs a rocket into Israel, and then they retaliate back. An eye for an eye, right? And then nobody can see, right? It's really helpful. So what do you want to blame? Put all the blame on one. What's the one? Self-cherishing. You're self-cherishing. That's all. Every time I'm self-absorbed. This is not about self-compassion. Different. Big distinction. Self-compassion is an equal balance and regard with my motivation. I want to benefit all living beings. The only way I can do that is to become a Buddha. The only way I can do it perfectly is to become a Buddha. Along the way, I will continue to help people. In order to do that, I've got to be okay myself. That's different. That's self-compassion. But self-cherishing, you know, get out of my way. I want this. I need this. I'm not going to let you in with my car. I need to be the first one in the grocery checkout. I'm going to rush over. I see you rushing over. I'm going to rush over, get in front of you. Self-cherishing, you know, self-absorption. Okay, that's what you blame. Number four, the power of prayer. The power of prayer. And Rinpoche says about the power of prayer, die with bodhicitta. That's your companion when you die. Nobody else is there with you. Die with bodhicitta. Having the mind that all I want to do is devote my life to getting enlightened to benefit others. Having in the mind that it's all about others. It's all about others. It's all about others. I just want to think about others. That's why Tonglin's so powerful at the death time. You can't practice much in life, but you can try to get mounted on your breath. I'm taking the suffering of others. I'm dying anyway. So let me take on all the suffering in my dying. Any pain people are having, I'm having a lot of pain. Let me take on that pain for them anyway. And it's not harming me. Let it harm my self-cherishing. It's like a constricted knot at my heart. That's what it harms. Okay? And then because I'm harming it from a place of deeper peace and happiness, I offer, I give. Every time I exhale, I give all that happiness and peace to all living beings, freeing them from suffering. Take on the suffering, give them my happiness. Take the suffering, give my happiness. If you die in that space, no problem. So die with bodhicitta. The fifth power, the power of training or habituation. So Rinpoche talks about try to die like the Buddha in the lion posture on your right side. Have people there that can help transfer your consciousness or doing practices around you like that. And that's what Rinpoche is talking about at the death time like that. Because the normal power of habituation is in your life, making those good imprints. Are you practicing now? Are you training your mind when it's keeping it away vigilantly from delusion like that? And the whole book is full of things like this. It's brilliant stuff. All kinds of things. It's totally complete. All you need is this at this point. I have it on my phone, just in case. Okay, I have it on my phone now. What's it? Sorry?
Is it an e-book?
I think it exists as an e-book, but somebody sent it to me in a form that I have on my phone, and the reason is, if I'm show up at somebody's bedside, I don't have all my books all the time. I can't travel. So I have stuff on my phone of the practices so I know I can right away do something for somebody. Just whip out your phone. At least make the phone useful in that way. Okay? And so there's some fantastic stuff in the book I highly recommend. Okay. Let's take 10 minutes. Now, when we take the 10 minutes, again, your conversations, if you choose to speak, is... what do you think about the four tasks of living and dying? Are there some adjustments you can make in your life? How's it been going for you? What are you pretty skilled with? What do you think about the five powers? What of those five powers has landed in your head that you feel like this is important to me, or this is, I'm headed in this direction, or I'm very far away from this? What kind of relationships might you need to resolve? How have you resolved some of them already that's worked well? Okay, so we'll take 10 or 15 minutes. Thank you.
So I had taken the death and rebirth class in the Discovering Buddhism series, and we did that meditation, and I came out...
Which meditation?
Like the disillusionment.
Disillusions, yep.
And later, after the class, I had a question of what do you hold on to while you are dying? Like, in life, we can breathe, and that kind of anchors me to be a better, make a better choice in the moment. But I would lose that while I'm dying. But I think the images, the way you describe them, would be very helpful to hold on to that, because my mind is going to be different in those moments.
Mm-hmm.
And then I liked reminding myself to look for the clear light.
Mm-hmm.
So I do have a question. How long does that process take?
I think it's individual based on the type of death you're having, based on your own imprints of those visions, and they say to do it every day more slowly so that you'll recognize the clear light, and but it's very individual, I think.
Okay.
I'm not sure if it's a sudden death. I think it would happen very quickly.
You might not have a chance to
like
even.
Like that. So it's an interesting question. What am I hanging on to? What was the wording you used? What can I hold on to?
Yeah, my anchor.
So your anchor?
My breathing is my anchor in life.
Right.
In difficult
situations. Don't even be attached to your next breath. Because that's going to create another cyclic existence for you.
Okay.
Any kind of grasping, any kind of hanging on, you have to totally let go. And they really say that, don't even be attached to your next breath. Because that's grasping. And we are, we grasp. Of course we're going to be, you know, there's going to be something. I think if you have to hang on to anything, hang on to the guru. Hang on to kind of absolute guru, like Dharmakaya, emptiness of the enlightened mind. Once you have some experience of that, there's really nothing we should be hanging on to. That's what's so hard. Because we hang on. We're hanging on all the time to something, one thing or another. So that's why it's training. It's training our mind. All we can do is try to train our mind. So we just assimilate familiarization.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes. Jill. Yeah. You're doing great, Lori.
Go, Lori.
She's my girl.
One thing that was different for me is there's just something about, and I think it sounds like you're emphasizing it too, that the whole mind is taken up with, let's just say the sparks, for example. For some, I just, you know, we keep hearing it, so we keep getting different pieces, but it was always something that's like, you're going to see sparks or something.
It's out there.
And it really changed when you said, this is all that you're doing.
This is your whole experience.
Yeah,
that your mind is merged with it, and you can actually actualize those states now, those visions, with highest yoga tantra completion stage practice. This is high level practice. If you get the right initiation, you get the right training, you have a right intention, and you continue to do these practices, there is this higher level practice, and it's all designed to get us to realize emptiness. And then the reason we would get emptiness is with shine. Mm-hmm. A meditative concentration, calm abiding. Excuse me. It's the only way you can get emptiness, to have a direct perception of emptiness. And so through this process, working with the subtle energy system, you're trying to bring these winds into the central channel. And when you do it properly, the visions appear automatically. That's all there is. That's your mind. That's your experience automatically. So you can actually, it doesn't mean you're dying. You do it with control, and you do it over and over to train yourself so that when it actually happens, when you're dying, you have a much more opportunity to get that most subtle mind, and that's where you can get enlightened. That's what helps you get enlightened. So that's what, again, this is all a rehearsal and familiarity and training my mind over and over with these experiences. There was one other thing I was going to say was... when you have sexual orgasm, the reason it's so blissful, right? If it's so blissful for you, for most people it's very, very blissful. You know, I haven't always been a nun, okay? The reason it's so blissful is because you get the winds close to entering the central channel when that happens. but they don't enter in the right way. So imagine if you get the winds in the right way. Imagine the bliss. But the bliss isn't just about the bliss. The bliss is about getting me enlightened so I can benefit all living beings. But imagine when you're around some of the lamas sometimes, all the stuff they handle, but sometimes they have this laughter that's so pure and, you know, and they're in this other kind of space, and because they've actualized those mind states. So we can do it. It just takes a lot of effort like that. Yeah, so I hope that's helpful. Yeah. Yes.
The different things like the mirage, the smoky room, the sparks, is that a correlation to the different elements? Like, say, for example, sparks is fire, smoky is water.
Yeah, so
element.
When I mentioned it, I said the earth element is dissolving.
Okay.
So the body is composed of the four elements, earth, water, fire, air, and then there's consciousness. And so those dissolve at each stage. So the form element of the earth dissolves, and that's where you have the mirage. And when the water element dissolves, you have the smoke. And when the fire element dissolves, you have the sparks. When the air element dissolves, you have the glow around the flickering candle.
When you were going through that, at one point you said, I believe respiration might stop here. And then at another, or your breath is very, very shallow and it may stop.
Mm-hmm.
And then at another point you said you may still be breathing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, two things. Is there a point at which respiration is definitely stopped? And is there a point where your heart stops? I'm thinking of people observing you. What mm-hmm. stage you might be
yes.
at, if you were good enough to actually go through these stages slowly.
Yes, and the reason I was saying that is the respiration can stop at different times when the grosser winds are dissolving, the grosser levels of the... So it can stop where we declare you dead, and then the visions can happen after, or some of the visions can start before that process. Mm-hmm. It's individual. So what people would be noticing from the outside, I believe, and I should check this, I believe this, is when the air element dissolves, and you get the glow around the fluttering, sputtering butter lamp or candle, then respiration ceases, as we would know it. And that's when we would declare somebody clinically dead, but it could cease before that with some of the other visions, depending on the kind of death you're having. So what you might notice in the outside, you won't notice their internal experience. We won't know that, usually, unless you're clairvoyant. And so the heart, my understanding with the heart is, the heart stops first, and then the breathing. Isn't it? Because the heart's driving the machine. So without the heart pumping, the lungs aren't functioning. So I don't think necessarily that the breathing stops.
Well, it's like an equalization of pressure.
Maureen is a nurse. So I think that the heart has to first stop, and then there could be a last. But I was just thinking, like my mother, for instance, it was almost simultaneous. Right, you know, there's like that last rattle. That last respiration can be real raspy. Exhalation. And I'm not sure which stopped first. Did that happen and then... But I think her heart had stopped and then there was one last...
I think there's like an equalization of pressure. Just physical air moving.
Could be, yeah, and it could be different in different experiences. Is there anything, Maureen, that's...
I don't, I'm not positive, but if you think about the brainstem, you know, controlling basic things like, you know, respirations and heart rate, maybe depending on what you're dying of or how it happened, maybe it could be different.
That's right. That's right. That would make, I mean, the brainstem certainly would be involved in part of that controlling, you know, the, yeah, and it's different with each person and the way you die stuff. So let me just go on a little bit about karma. This isn't a course on karma. Some of you have done courses on karma, but I just wanted to, well, hold that thought. We'll come back to, karma is such so heavily in the mix here. And we're somewhat aware of karma. Karma, again, is cause and effect. It means action, actually. Action. It's the movement of your consciousness, your mind. So what we're trying to do from this moment on, how to get ready for death, is just as I've been saying, not only cultivating the spiritual practice, but from this moment on, being kind, considerate, trying to practice, acknowledging my humanness, that I'm going to mess up at times, and there's purification practices I can do. And your motivation is a major, major factor for everything. So I try to reestablish my motivation as much as I can to recall what, you know, I can be having a meal, my motivation, going to the bathroom, like you try to, so that my mind's always in the right setting. It's always in the right setting. Now, I can't always do it, but I try to get that rebalanced, and that, because that's going to inform and make more imprints of virtue in my mind. And so that will be there helping my life, helping everything I'm doing now to make more imprints. And then there's more we could say, and I've already talked a little bit about lower realms and things. But let me talk about more specifics of getting yourself actually ready. See, I talked about this. Okay. Just want to make sure I get everything in. And I hope in the future we can really do something longer like that if people are interested, or kind of retreat or something like that. Okay. So we talked about organ donation. Okay. Euthanasia. Just want to get to some practical things. So euthanasia, we as Buddhists, technically, we do not euthanize even your pets. That's hard for people. Now, again, it's an individual decision, and every being, every mind is different. So I know with humans, if you're on a Buddhist path, you may have the advantage to check with a great lama, somebody highly realized, who knows, capital K knows, okay? Meaning, what would you do is, one man I know in our community in California was he in his 40s, dying of colon cancer. Family was there, connected to one of our centers. They checked with Rinpoche about it. This is if the family's in agreement. You don't want to check as a Buddhist member of the family and the rest of the family doesn't want to follow the instructions. Don't do that. You can discuss with the family. You know, my mother was dying in the hospital, and I actually said to my brother and father, would you like me to ask Rinpoche, he's on the East Coast, would you like me to see if he could stop by? I said, I don't know that he can, but I said, no obligation, but only if you're interested, don't feel. And they were both like, yeah, we want him to come. Like, can he come? I wasn't going to request unless I knew they were on board, because you don't want the resistance of, so you don't want to just ask, because you're the Buddhist member of the family, and you ask, and you're like, well, the Lama said that we should disconnect the life support. And nobody's into that, and they're not going to follow the instruction. It's not helpful to not follow the instruction when you seek advice. So Rinpoche's advice to him, to the family, was to keep him on life support as long as possible. Rinpoche obviously saw something in his mind or whatever and felt it was better that he continue, and they did. And then another person I know, the father was dying in his 70s, heart attack, and Rinpoche said, call the family together, four kids, all Buddhists, all students, Rinpoche, call the family. The mother was there. And he said, once everyone's there and you do these prayers, then you can disconnect the life support. And they did, and he lived 24 more hours, and he passed away. So everything's individual. So we tend to not try to create a situation where you're creating some negative karma, even though you have a good motivation. It still reaps a little bit of negative seeds there. Your motivation. I'll take questions later, a little bit later. The motivation will color the outcome of the karma. You know, so if you have very pure motivation, it changes something negative. So the same thing with our pets. And this is hard because some people think it's cruel. But we don't euthanize people. Why do we euthanize pets? Sometimes they do. That's right. So it's an individual decision. So what we try to do, and I know people think it's cruel, but you can get painkillers for pets. You can break up painkillers for size. I've gotten sleeping pills. I've played mantra tapes for pets and taken them around stupas and waited till they naturally ended whatever suffering, whether it's cancer, things, and better to let them naturally finish out that rebirth, because they say if you abort it, if you cut it short, they may end up taking rebirth. There's some karma there not finished. So they may end up taking rebirth and die as a sick young child or something like that that hasn't finished. Again, it's not definite. These things are not, I mean, karma's definite, but it's not, you can't exactly say this is going to happen, and unless you're clairvoyant and you know, like that. You try to make the animal comfortable, and I know it is a pain in the butt for you. I know that. I've taken care of animals. We say it's inconvenient. The dog has incontinence problems, and okay, well, this is something, as a Buddhist, it's your personal decision. How do you feel? Do you want to do it? Do you, you know, and I do know some Buddhists that have euthanized their pets, and some really regretted it, and some that didn't, and it's just different things. You can get people to help. I've helped people with their pets, and you do the best you can, like that. And it, so it's a tricky one. So we just tend to naturally let them ride out what's going on, because even if it's suffering for a couple of weeks, that may be better than them having to go through the whole rebirth again and then end up getting sick again and going through those kind of things. Another thing I wanted to mention is suicide. So whatever you do, do not commit suicide, okay? It is a very bleak experience of the mind, it must be, and it cuts a very jagged edge through everybody around you. So what it please... find out if somebody near you is depressed, chronically depressed, suicidal. Get them professional help. Find out the numbers of suicide hotlines. Ask them if you can be direct with people. If they're depressed and suicidal, the thing is to ask directly, how would you do it? Ask the person. Have you been thinking about how you do it? Just they say ask them, because if the person has a method and they're immediately like, yes, I would hang myself, or I got a gun, then they're serious about it. And they're quite high risk for committing suicide. Some people are kind of like, no, I really never thought about it. I just said I'd kill myself, but lesser risk. But please get them help. Sometimes medication can help for you to deal with some of the loose ends and the anxiety and all these things. Professional, I would say good counseling. Make sure it's a good fit with a good therapist. Can be enormously helpful. And I would say meditation practice, along with that, are the people that have made the most success dealing with anxiety and depression, where they have a combination of efforts. The other thing is about grief I wanted to mention. So grief is a very normal experience you need to traverse through when you lose a loved one or a pet. And it can't be rushed. And don't worry about people that are uncomfortable with your grief and they want you to get over it quickly. And they'll say, it's already been 2 months. It's a problem. You know, don't give in to that. So the normal death cycle of a human, natural death or old age or cancer, the normal grief cycle for you, the one left behind, is about 2 years. Meaning you'll be sad, you'll find yourself sobbing in the middle of the day about, you know, walking down the grocery store aisle, and you'll burst into tears. You'll be irritable. You won't want to do anything fun. You won't find any luster in life. You're just sad all the time. And that cycle can go for about 2 years, and it goes up and down. You know, you're suddenly near the end, you're feeling like better, and then the next day you just can't get out of bed. Very common. And with sudden deaths and premature deaths, and deaths out of trauma like suicide, the cycle can be longer for the people left behind. So you need to give yourself some space for the grieving process. It's a natural process. And other people do get uncomfortable with your grief. And that's just too bad. You know, I really try not to get in, you know, if somebody's uncomfortable and people say, you know, silly things, they don't know what to say. And you may find that you're relating not to any of your normal friends you're relating if they're not supporting you in the right way, and you suddenly find some other friends that seem to really be there. It's okay. You know, you may not decide to go out for very long, and you may want to get a grief counselor. can be really helpful, especially people I know that have young kids that went through some death of a parent. Or grief counseling is a specific type of counseling, and it can be really helpful if you find the right person to deal with the grief. I know there's also now online support groups. So my sister was in one of these groups. Her my brother-in-law committed suicide in 2002, leaving my sister and two young boys, and it was a nightmare. He was mentally ill for 11 years, and wonderful, wonderful man. So she wasn't a real person into counseling and therapy. So she found an online group, SOS, Spouses of Suicides, okay? That worked for her. It was impersonal enough, but hugely, well, I'll take questions a little bit later, yeah. Hugely helpful. So there's groups online for people that have lost kids and people that have lost partners of 47 years, and sometimes it's helpful. And then what happened after a few years, when she thought her life was over and it would never, time heals. Time's an amazing healer. So later, she went on the group, checking back again after she wasn't using much, and she could be there for somebody new that lost their partner to a suicide. And suddenly she was giving back. So those groups and support groups can be enormously helpful. I know some parents that lost kids to an accident, suicide, and they joined a group in utter grief and loss. And those people tended to do better in their lives of picking up the pieces than people that didn't and kind of closed in. And also a lot of people get divorced after losing a child. Can't seem to, you know, there's a lot of blame and things like that. So again, put all the blame on one, self-cherishing, not on your partner who's also grieving and like that. It's very, very challenging. So the grief counseling, and grief is just a normal thing to allow yourself and be good to yourself in a balanced way. You know, find out what are the things that support you and protect you and make you feel safe and nurtured and supported, and do that. Do that. I mean, with balance. If you need to still go to work, you go to work. And if you, but, and setting boundaries can be really helpful in the process. And some of your friends may not like it. And they're just going to have to get on board. You know, it's your loss. They've also experienced some of the loss, but there's people I know that really, you know, wanted my sister to be like this, and they needed her to start dating at this time, or you want somebody to come to the movies with you. That's really going to make you feel better. And so you need to kind of know the signals, too. So if you're very close to somebody, me and my sister, at the five-year mark, roughly around 5 years after her husband died, me and some of her closest friends started discussing with her online dating. We just felt, you know, she was just like, I'll never date again. I'm never, you know, my life's over. Okay. So we just kind of, things were moving in a positive way, and I posed it to her, and she snapped at me. I'm not interested in, don't put a profile up for me. I don't want to hear it. Okay. Now I know my sister. I said, okay. I backed off. I'm not going to push it. I know her. But then, so a few months later, the idea was planted. The idea was there in her mind. And then some of her friends kind of come from the sides. You know? And then in her own time, a few months later, she decided on her own to put up a profile. That was her, that's how she does it. She doesn't want, okay, so I just back off. But there could be a friend who loses someone and you may feel that they need a nudge. Come on. And there are some people I know, when you say to somebody that's grieving and you go over to their house and they just lost their husband, or, and often people say, like, let me know if there's anything I can do for you. They're not going to call you. Often they're not, rarely, unless you're very close. You know, my sister could call me, but we don't live near each other. So what I did is, I have some neighbors and one got breast cancer. There's certain people that I knew, and somebody that lost his wife when I was living in New York, in Vermont, and I just came with the soup. I just showed up with a big thing of soup, and I think I called him first. I'm just coming by. I just want to check if you're home. I'm dropping off the soup, you know. And I got there and said, you don't need to talk to me. You don't need to entertain me. I'm just here to drop it off. I'm just here to drop it off. So sometimes you might want to, I'm just going to do this, or you leave it on the door, a note. There it is. I'm still going to do that, but I'm not going to get in your face that you don't need to talk to me if you don't want to. But And sometimes there are occasionally things of, you know, let's go out for a walk today. You know, where you do know it's time to push a little bit just to go out and get some fresh air, which can help a housebound griever because the fresh air is a healer. Fresh air heals a lot of things, and we forget that. And also you're in the winter and everything's closed up and the heat's on. Some fresh air is an amazing medicine. So that might be that little nudge of, okay, how about 10 minutes? We just go outside for 10 minutes. And then they go out and they're, you know, okay, it's okay out here. It's safe out here. And then it's 10 minutes later, you go home. Fine. So you kind of try to know the balance. The other thing is when you show up with grieving people to their house, like I just mentioned, we had this extended family, their 15-year-old son committed suicide. Sometimes there's no words. You don't need to fill it with words that are... And so we went to the house to visit my brother, his family, and me. And I know the parents a little bit. I know the mother a little better. They were broken. They were complete pieces of people. It was horrible. And I'd gone to the funeral, and then a couple nights later went to the house. And I from having some experience with my brother-in-law, so I just saw the mother, and then, you say, you're so sorry. And I just looked at her, and I said, I'm sorry, I don't really know what to say. And she said, and she just threw her arms around me. Because instead of all the little blah, blah, silly stuff people say, and my brother couldn't stand when my mother died. Everybody has their own thing, but she's in a better place now. There was that one. That was special. My brother hated that. He goes, how do they know where she is? You know, she's in a better place now. You know, so some of those things I find people say them out of, you think you're supposed to say those things. We have a habit. Make another habit. So finally the mother was alone at one point on the landing. I saw her and I just went over and said, I don't know if you're aware, and I know you have your own support network, but, my family had a suicide. You know, I said my brother-in-law, my sister's husband, committed suicide then, and she just kind of magnetized to me, you know, wanting information. Like suddenly when you experience that, you're in a different group, a different club suddenly. And it was hard. You know, she wanted to know, did he leave a note? And my brother-in-law did, but her son didn't. So she has all these questions, you know, of wondering. You wonder sometimes about what could it have been something else? Could it have been, you know, it's just so, but I just said to her, if you want somebody separate from your support group and you just want to rage and cry and just talk it out with somebody completely separate, safely, you know, like that, just so it's another resource. And she said she was quite grateful for that, you know, to have, and sometimes you don't need to say anything, you just go, you know. If it's, this is a funny thing. So Jewish tradition is they have a very, very, each spirituality has some really good traditions based on, the Jewish tradition has Shiva. You sit for 7 days and the mourners sit and they usually sit on stools, low stools. Traditionally they will wear black clothing that were ripped rags because it's supposed to be your grief, like tear your clothes to pieces and you cover all the mirrors in the house so you're not interested in adorning yourself, and it's mourning. You go inside, you go in to really experience the mourning and the grief to come out the other side. If you bottle it up, like some traditions and things, it's always there under the surface. You know, Jews aren't about that generally. But the other thing that Jews do, if you're aware, and if you ever have a Jewish friend that loses a parent or somebody, don't send flowers. If you're aware of the Jewish tradition, send food. Jews eat in their grief. We eat, okay? So you go to the house, and what you do is there's a service. And you need at least 10 adults for the service to read the special prayer for the W. You read a few prayers. It takes like a half an hour. Everybody together just stands in the house or sits in the house. Family is there. It's very healing. It's very nurturing. And everybody knows, and you go to somebody's house, and it might be like a cousin of the friends, because you're supposed to be served as the mourner. You're not supposed to do anything. But often it's in your house, and there is a lavish spread of food. And so you eat with people. That's healing in the Jewish tradition. You know, you want to get together and you eat, and you, and people help clean up, and they do. But it's an interesting tradition where often people send flowers, but in the Jews, nobody sends flowers. It's all food. And people will come over for days with hold dinners for your family, because you're not supposed to cook or eat, so you can grieve. It's a brilliant tradition. I find it very, very helpful. Very, very helpful like that. And my mother was kind enough to pass away in the winter so we could use our porch for storage, because there was so much food. We had no place to, you know, I kept saying, well, put it on the porch. We'll get it on, you know. But it is helpful to know different traditions. Some people, some Irish friends of mine, have a very boisterous wake. Everybody, you know, with a lot of beer, and that was what, you know, my friend who died would have wanted. Everybody would have a party and be drinking his favorite, you know, home brews and like that. So you find the tradition of the way you want to do it, and maybe some of you have come to some interesting things through thinking about a memorial service or a funeral. You know, any interesting insights from a bucket list? Just curious.
A short one. I always wanted to do a fire walk.
Yay! Okay. Right on. There you go. That's on a bucket list. I did a fire walk once. It was pretty empowering. Long time ago. You know, I lived in California. You know, this is a California thing. What they do is they make a bonfire, okay? And while they're making the bonfire, huge, and letting it burn down to coals, bed of coals, like an aisle, is you're normally inside with some kind of, I'm going to call facilitator, New Age facilitator, who's taking you through various exercises to get you into your empowerment phase to walk across barefoot the hot coals. Right? This is California. This is what we do in California. So I had a friend that one night just said, hey, you want to go to this fire walk? We'll do this thing. And I'd heard about, you know, I went many years ago. We went, and it was really fun. It was really empowering. Yeah, it was a fun. We hosted one at Vajrapani, but the premise has to be really good and open, and the premise we did was all about helping others, this thing, and nobody got burned. It was in such a great container. However, we hosted one at Vajrapani that was not our program. We rented the space. They wanted this space, and when the guy came, his people kind of had organized it. I didn't get a good feeling from him at all. It was all about him and money and, you know, it just wasn't, and many people burn their feet in the firewall. Because it was, you know, so anyway, see how it goes for you, right? Dedicate the merit to send, but it can be empowering. You know, people in California, they do various things to empower people in ways, and some people find those things helpful like that. Now, you had a question, please. Take a couple questions, and I want to, before we finish, yeah.
Sometimes at night when I get up, just for a moment, I've been in a deep sleep, I come back. When I close my eyes, I actually see almost like a rolling motion. It's white, black, white, black, white, black. Mm. It's like it's flashing. And then sometimes when I'm sleeping, I see either just red behind my eyelids or blue, or it kind of looks like the universe kind of expanding and opening up. Is that part of the things you're talking about that we'll see?
I'm not sure about those visions, but a lot of times when you close your eyes, you have different experiences depending on the light in the room,
yeah.
what you ate, but there's lots of things like that when people start meditating, so I'm not exactly sure what those would be. That's not as related, I mean, it's not exactly the visions.
Okay,
but
all right.
I wouldn't worry so much. Sometimes we have lots of visions. We start meditating or you close your eyes. And often it can be distraction. I just let it go like
okay.
that. No worries. Now, somebody over here. Yes, please.
Resource for grieving. There's an organization, Transitions, and it's just a couple miles down the road. And they have a hospice and they have grief. A lot of different programs around grief. There's support groups, there's lecture series, there's kind of art therapy. And it's much like here, it's open to the public. Anybody can come regardless of finances, and then you give a donation. and the people there are really wonderful, and a lot of the programs are offered quarterly.
Great. Thank you. That's great.
I really appreciate the information about euthanasia, but I wanted to know what the relationship would be with the do not resuscitate order.
Okay, thank you. Great, because I want to just talk about this. We will have time for some more questions, but I do want to get through, and this is a good segue. And again, euthanasia, it is a personal decision. So you have your pet, and you're just like, I can't handle this, and it's your own decision. You can always purify, but just to be honest about Buddhism, as Buddhism would say, even though you have a good motivation for euthanizing your pet, they say it creates a little bit of a negative imprint in your mind, because you're killing, you're authorizing somebody to kill like that. So let me talk about, in getting your papers ready and DNRs, thank you, do not resuscitate, is this document. This is just one document called Five Wishes. And this is available from Hospice of Palm Beach County, West Palm Beach, but it's also from, there's another place in Tallahassee, Aging with Dignity. Many places have this document. It's common. Yeah, you can Google it and find it. And it's, I think it's legal in the state of North Carolina. It is. Great. It's not legal everywhere. But so this is a really easy document for a living will. The five wishes are, the person I want to make care decisions for me when I can't, the kind of medical treatment I want or don't want, how comfortable I want to be, how I want people to treat me, and what I want my loved ones to know. And what they do is they give you very specific things that you can fill in. You can use their examples. There's spaces to write. You want to write something different. You write it all out there. And it has, for instance, your healthcare agent. You've got to think about this person. Will they, and discuss with them at an appropriate time, find the time to discuss. Are they like-minded with you? You know, my brother, who's really close to me, lives near me, would be able to take care of some of this stuff, and he's great. He's totally great, but he has a really hard time letting go. So there might be a thing where I'm like, I'm out of here, you know, and he's going to be like, no, you know, we're going to put the feeding tube in, and so you want to make sure that they're okay with that. They're okay to do it. These are your wishes. You've agreed, but you can get very specific. So for instance, it'll have, regarding life support, just take that for an example. I want to have life support treatment, period. Okay. I don't want it. And even if it started, I don't want it. I want it stopped. Okay, that's one view. And then another one is, I want to have life support treatment if my doctor believes it could help. So you can be specific. If they think there's a chance that you'll recover, if they think there's a chance you're going to recover in a vegetative state and live, do you want life support? And you can write that down. If you think you'll recover, but you're going to be in a wheelchair incapacitated with a breathing tube, do you want that? Some people do. Some people are like, no. So this is all the stuff, and it has life support, the wish for my medical treatment, if I'm in a coma and not expected to wake up or recover. But you could be in a coma where there's brain activity, so then I do want something. So you write it down. You know, permanent and severe brain damage, not expected to recover. I want life support. I don't want life support. You can check the boxes, different boxes. You want something special, write it. You write down the specific things. It's very, very specific. And it has about the do not resuscitate. So here's things about how comfortable I want to be. I do not want to be in pain. I want my doctor to give me enough medicine to relieve my pain, even if it means I'll be drowsy or sleep more than I would otherwise. So for me, I cross out, and I've got a thing about I want a balance. I want pain medicine to relieve some of the pain, but I want to be lucid enough to do my practice. Now, that's going to be a hard balance, but at least, you know, it's in there. I don't want to be totally zapped on morphine where I'm out of it. I'd like not to be, you know, but I might have a line, I might add a line. I'm actually updating mine now, where if I'm in really, really bad pain, can they give it to me periodically just to relieve the pain? But, you know, so it's your specific things. How you want people to treat you. I wish to have pictures of my loved ones in my room near my bed. Some people want that. Some people don't want any of that. Get too much attachment. I want to die in my home if that can be done. Now, let's think about it. You really want to die at home. Okay, a lot of people do. You have to consider who is going to take care of you. What is that going to do to your partner, your kids? What's the environment like? Is the home designed for a wheelchair and a hospital bed? And what will that be like? Is the bed going to be in the living room of the house? Where, you know, so it could go on for 8 months, and then you got your spouse there living with that. It's a joint decision in those cases. If you're married and have a family, how's that going to go? And I know that my next door neighbor, his second wife died, the poor guy, he's 80 now. He's lived next door to me since I was 16, and I went to high school with his son. They moved in, I guess we were 14, 15, 16. And so his second wife died, who was 12 years younger than him, of cancer. She really wanted to die at home, and it was brutal on him. It was killing him. He was the main caregiver. So it was just really hard for him, and managing her care. He was afraid he was going to kill her. He was afraid he wouldn't get her to the hospital in time if she stopped breathing. And they went to the hospital very near the end. She had cancer all over, but she couldn't breathe suddenly. He rushes her to the hospital. She's there, and he's thinking, like, okay, this is it. And then she rallied, and they regulated the breathing, and she could breathe. And then she said the fateful words, like, you know, I want to go home. You know, and he brought her home, and she passed away 2 days later. But he just said to me it was killing him. It was just so hard for him. So you have to kind of discuss with your partner before you're incapacitated, is it manageable? Can you do it? Can you get enough support there to do it? There are people that are in hospitals and all the beeping and the loudness of hospitals and the bells and whistles. And then my friend's father, he just finally said, I'm not doing dialysis anymore. I'm done. And that was it. And they all decided, and the kids were there, and grown kids, and that was it. And then they had a hospice in the hospital. So they just wheeled him around the corner to a new room. And they said when they got there, it was so peaceful. It was like a new dimension. And then he slowly, you know, the kidney back up, and then he kind of went to sleep, and then a few days later he passed away. So this is the five wishes, which would include your DNR, your do not resuscitate. I do know places where people have this stuff and they don't pay attention to them. But what I would do is get your papers together. This is one part of it. Then there's a will, last will and testament. That's separate. That's for your stuff. So you'd have both of these. And then you may have, I have another sheet of who are the lamas I want called, you know, who call and update the emails and the phone numbers regularly because they change. And the lamas pass away. So who's the next person they'll call, and who's the next person, and where do they live so they know when to call them? So I have a list of that, right? And then I think I mentioned it here before, I finally recorded all my prayers, and I have a sheet of the prayers. What gets done, and then I have the memory stick. So what you want to do is make copies. If you can, make 3 copies, okay? And at least give it to 1 or 2 other people, or maybe a third person, and ask them specifically, this is my end-of-life care. Could you do me a favor in the next month? Could you look it over, make sure you understand, and check that the memory stick works, that it's going to, you know, you might even want to put 2 in just in case one fails, and just say, can you tell me if you're comfortable with this? Do you understand it? Do you have any questions? And then they'll keep it and make sure there's somebody that can keep it in a place where they know where they can find it. And then hopefully maybe they'll be around. You know, sometimes you're out of the country or someplace else, and you just hope that, you know, there's somebody that you could impart something to. But usually somehow people get taken care of. Somehow it works out. And I found amazing stuff where, nobody had this and stuff. And it's just somehow there's a natural thing. I feel like we're, in the Buddhist thing, we're held in, you know, especially having a lama like Lama Zopa Rinpoche, where he's aware of what's going on with his students, and somehow there's something holding us. I really believe that. I've really seen that. You do the best you can. So people somehow rally to help take care of people like that. It may not be exactly what you're hoping, but sometimes for me, honestly, there's this very special special prayer about cultivating, I can't remember the name of it. It's the nine attitudes, or the not nine attitudes of guru devotion, but it's how you'd like to die. And a lot of it is, can I die alone? And can I, like, give up, like, die like a pauper where I'm not worried about the thing? Can I be like a dog where I'm not worried about, the, you know, to really, and I think of how it would be the least problem for anybody. That's what I would like, the least hassle. You know, if you have these wishes, and did anybody see the movie The Bucket List?
Yeah.
Jack Nicholson, Morgan Freeman. It's a great movie. It's a really fun movie. But to ask somebody to take my ashes to the top of Mount Everest is really not very convenient for my family. Right? You know, like, be reasonable. I want my corpse flown home from southern France. For what a hassle for your family. You know, I want the ashes scattered in, you know, Tanzania for, you know, at sunset on December. You know, down the toilet bowl, you know, yeah. Think about the people after you if you're making some requests like that. If it's somebody where they're like, yeah, hey, that sounds great, I'll make sure that happens, that's different. But in general, there's certainly areas you might want your ashes scattered. That's fine. But is it reasonable for the people you're leaving instructions with? And does that help with the DNR of the paperwork? And so the other thing with the DNR is the medical system where I live, there's five hospitals connected. It's a very good medical system. My father's part of it. You can register these papers, so it automatically pops up there, because a friend of mine rushed his mother to the hospital. She couldn't breathe. The hospital's job is to keep her alive. She had papers, and she did not want to be resuscitated and didn't want a breathing tube. But he didn't have the papers with him. So he had to drive back 45 minutes to get the papers. And by the time he came back, she was on a ventilator, completely in distress, trying to pull the tube out. So an hour and a half later, he comes back with the papers and then was like, here's the papers. You can just disconnect the tube now. So it's sometimes helpful to have them ready, have them. And also with powers of attorney, this is an interesting one. My father has it for me and my brother and sister. We've done it for my dad, so we are the power of attorney. But you have to submit that power of attorney to all the agencies with his ID, whether it's a Veterans Association, whether it is Social Security, his bank, different bank accounts, and different his prescription plan, his insurance company, Medicare, they won't talk to you, and they won't do anything unless they're like, do we have the power of attorney? So I had to mail stuff in, I had to scan it, I had to fax it and make sure, and now it's registered. And each doctor we go to now, each new doctor, we make sure that privacy form that he designates, and we right away fill out that you can talk to these people. And the son and daughter are on there with our address and phone number. So I'm just so used to doing it now, because I couldn't talk to anybody and get any information. And my father didn't want to call, and he didn't know any of his. So here's another thing. On your list, put all your passwords. Logins and passwords. There I was, trying to access my father's stuff online. He had set up online accounts. He was savvy enough to do it. He didn't keep any of the passwords. So his name is Marvin, okay? So he has a password, Marvy something, okay? And they were all different derivations of Marvy something. But Marvy with a capital M. Marvy, M-A-R-V-Y. M-A-R-V-E-Y. Different years that he happened to do the thing. It was just unbelievable trying to reaccess the passwords and the logins. And when I would say send a new password or send the link for me to make a new password, it would go to his email account that he didn't know how to access anymore. So this is, and I knew a woman that she didn't know her husband's passwords, couldn't access any of their money or anything like that. So think about that. That's now, if you want somebody to access your Facebook page and put on that you passed away and stuff, they need your passwords. They need the logins and stuff, if that's important to you. So lastly, I just wanted to mention is just in general how to help. Make sure I went. One thing I just wanted to mention briefly is POWA, P-O-W-A or P-H-O-W-A is transference of consciousness. Transference of consciousness. This is a very Buddhist practice. You can get trained in doing this. It's something you can more quickly realize, that the actualize the practice. But POWA is, you could do this for Buddhists by trained people. Somebody dies and you want to make sure the consciousness leaves from a good opening, or that the consciousness is gone. And so you can ask a lama and ask somebody and say, should we do a POWA? My mother, we didn't do. I just did all the death practices, called the lama, and he said, yeah, now it's okay to remove her body, like that. So, but sometimes people, more Tibetan, they'll do a POWA and like that. I went to one sky burial. This is another way in Tibet people will dispose of a body. And they did a POWA first in the Gompa of the monastery in Tibet to make sure the consciousness was gone before they would basically offering the body to vultures and to the animals. And it was really a spiritual ritual. It wasn't anything, I mean, part of it was gruesome, but when you watch the whole thing to the end, it was one of the most efficient ways I've seen of disposing of a body. And they do it in Tibet still. So it took about an hour, and it feeds a lot of vultures, and at the end it feeds the dogs that clean up. It was on a holy, sacred site, like a mandala, which was just a stone thing with a lama and two monk attendants, all trained. And it was quite extraordinary watching the whole thing like that. So let me just do a few things. When you're taking care, and when you're taking care of people that are not Buddhist, please, it's helpful not to foist your agenda on them. They're not Buddhist. They're not going to be Buddhist. Okay, so if I'm called in to talk with somebody who's dying or they're actively dying, I try very much to find out from the family what's their belief system, what would they like, you know. And if it's Jesus, then I might talk to them about Jesus, or they might have a picture of Jesus there, or Mary or something like that, you know, if that's their experience. Some people are atheists, they have no belief system. It would be more trying to relax somebody. You know, you've trying to remind them of all the good they've done in their life and the good things, and letting go of the regrets at that point. And so mainly trying to keep people calm and peaceful and keeping any agitation out of the room. And you can also, if you're in a hospital, I know in our area, hospitals are not the greatest places to die. And there's good and bad healthcare practitioners, you know, people that aren't all that good at what they're doing, and then there's some brilliant people. So we learned that we were in a place and the nursing was really bad, and there were some really awful nurses and things like that. So we learned that you could request not to have somebody on their service to help, and then they would make a note and that person was never allowed in the room. So you can actually sometimes do that, and you can also discuss in advance, according to your belief system, what you want. And this person's Buddhist, so I'm wondering how long would it be possible for us to do some practices with the body after the person's died? How long can we remain in the room? You can just discuss that. They're usually, I found now in my area, they're very, very spacious. They gave me a lot of time. There was no rush. And Rinpoche came to the hospital 3 hours one night, and I went before, and I just mentioned my Buddhist priest. I said to them, is it okay if he comes? And it's easier at night because there's less people there, there's less visitors, there's less medical appointments and testing and stuff. So Rinpoche came at the optimum time. Of course, he knew when to come, and stayed 3 hours, and there was no one else in a room, so it was quite easy. And usually they can't say anything because a priest is allowed to come. So why not a Buddhist priest? Like, yes, I've never had a problem like that. things. So, but it's good to get clear if a hospital is very rigid and they're very busy and they need the bed and they're, you know, you might be able to make other arrangements before that. So when you are coming in to help people that are Buddhists, I mentioned the practices, but just in general, you're helping people. How to help, okay? When you come in, and it could be the family, it could be the person dying, try not to hand out advice. Can you just be there? Just be with them. You don't necessarily need to hand out advice all the time, okay? The other thing is seeing the ordinariness of death. It's a part of life. So there may be drama kings and queens around you. Everything's hysterical and stuff. You can lend kind of more peaceful setting to that. I see people get hysterical and I'll go, okay, you know. Expressing friendship in the face of death. That can be helpful for the spouse that's left or the person that's dying. You know, some friends of mine, having that last pizza party was important, I remember, for one of my friends. She, all of a sudden, you know, I want to have a pizza party right now. She couldn't really eat, but I want to have a pizza party. She just, that thing. So, like, yeah, that's what we do. That was our friendship. Let's do that. And then communicating honestly. Most of you are aware of these things. Communicating honestly. Showing up when I mentioned before, my friend that got confused at her bed when she's actively dying, and then the friend next to me, when she said, what's happening? You're dying. That this is what's going on. You're in active dying right now. You know, better than coloring it up with, you know, you look great. You're, you know. Talking simply can be really helpful. Trying to make eye contact with the person dying, very helpful. Not freaking out. So if you need to break down and sob, take it out of the room. You know, I was staying with people once, with, you know, and I went in the shower, took my shower, turned the water on, put the fan on, and just sobbed in the shower. I didn't want them to hear me. So you need a break. You need to break down some. You need to just cry it out sometimes, but take a walk. Go out of the house like that. It's perfectly fine, but you don't need to freak out in front of these people or contribute to any more hysteria. And then the other thing is, you know, dealing with pain and suffering. So one is, how do I deal with my own pain and suffering? Because if I'm managing my own pain and suffering in general, then when I'm with other people's pain and suffering, I'm a little bit more present. And again, I've mentioned this so many times before, my spiritual practice is getting comfortable with the uncomfortable. Samsara is uncomfortable. So the more I can kind of just face that, and you know what, just be with it. I don't have to fix it. I can't fix it like that. Can we learn to get comfortable? We're always trying to either numb ourselves out, I'm busy myself up, talking incessantly out of nervousness. It doesn't necessarily help anything. Sometimes I'll just sit there quietly, you know. Yeah, it sucks that she's dying, you know. Nothing to say about it. The other thing with death is allowing chaos. But you can be calm in the chaos. My mother's hospital room at times, during the day, like, they came in with the chest x-ray. And at the same time they came with the chest x-ray, the wound care guy showed up. Then he showed up with a team of doctors. They wanted to do this. Then they were going to try this other medical thing. Then the regular nurse came to turn her. Then they came with another person to turn her. Then they needed to take blood. And this was sometimes in a half an hour. You know, I'm in the room trying to do a medicine Buddha practice. I just allowed them. They had to do their things, and eventually they left the room. And then another person, how's it going? Left the room. And then suddenly I'd be there an hour. I'd be quiet. But it's like that. Sometimes it's just, and sometimes there's an emergency and something changes and everybody rushes in and then everybody rushes out and you're, it's just like that. Just like that. So the politics of dying. Hospital rooms, you've got relatives that want this. This sibling doesn't talk to this sibling, but they come in and I know what's best for mom, and mom wanted this, and dad didn't want the, you know, in the hospital. And then you've got doctors that are pushing you to let the person go. There's nothing we can do. And somebody else is saying, no, we can do something. There's a new test. There's a new trial. So calmly, like, take it down the hall and sit with your family, that find a way to communicate and discuss, you know, rationally what you think is the best decision. And then I'd say, you know, the final thing is to maintain a sense of humor. There is humor in dying. Maintain a sense of humor. My sister and brother, with my mother 7 months in the hospital declining, mostly in a coma, each month she declined more. And we were, you know, and so at one point the doctor gave us one report about, you know, 5 months in. And somehow I had a real wake-up call at the 5 months. And then my brother called me, and he said, so what do you think, you know, about what he said? And I said, I think that I just kind of got knocked off my little island of denial suddenly, and now I'm flailing around in the water saying, you know, like, because you go through phases. And so we would kind of joke about that, of my brother watching a baseball game with my mother in a coma. Like, but with the, you know, they have the, what do you call it, the TV speaker by the bed. So he was saying, Mom, you know, so-and-so just got a home run. You know, did you see? You really liked him. So it's different humor. And then one more humorous, and then we'll finish up with some questions. There's so much more we could talk about. We're running out of time. The So I had a friend that, a very close friend of mine, I just saw him briefly. His brother was one of the first AIDS patients to die in New York, and the brother was an arts critic and a very funny, sarcastic kind of guy with a sharp sense of humor and a little bit sharp talk. And so he got AIDS and he was dying, but what was tragic is his parents didn't know he was gay until they found out he had AIDS. So the parents find out he's gay, big shock, and they find out he's dying. And in those days, in the early 80s, you died really quickly. So he lasted about a year and a half. And the parents had divorced. They had remarried. They all had kids from the different marriages. And the whole family came back together at his hospital bed. The mother was from Long Island, New York. If you know Long Island, it's like its own country, right? She was from Long Island, New York. Traditional kind of Jewish housewife with a heavy accent. And the son was close with her, but he wanted her, when he became ill, he really wanted her to read some New Age books about death and dying, like Stephen Levine, Who Dies, and things about, you know, talking about Go to the Light and things like this. So bless her heart, the mother read some of these books. It wasn't anything really she'd ever be interested in, but for her son, she read these books. She read the books, and at the very end, they're all around the bed, and he's been pretty much in a coma for a couple of days, not responding. And she leans over the bed, and the nurses were saying it's probably going to be soon, and this is her son, right? She leans over him, and she says, Stephen, go to the light. Go to the light. Like, and unbelievably, he picked up his head a little bit, and he said, I'm trying, Mom. I'm trying. Seriously. So there is that, right? So for practice, for yourself, basic mindfulness meditation you can do. Tonglen meditation, incredibly powerful, right? Super one is meditation on emptiness. You've got those going at the death time. Pretty smooth sailing, okay? And here's other things. Living ethically. Living ethically. Living kindly. Now, studying spiritual teachings. Taking refuge. Doing purification practices. Becoming more familiar with what actually happens at the death time and what happens afterwards. Reciting mantras. Very helpful. Eventually getting tantric initiation and doing some deity practices and self-initiations where you purify all your vows sets up a very positive foundation for your mind. And serving the center. Incredible. Serving others, volunteering, helping people, creating a good livelihood for yourself, like people that are nurses here, teachers, caregivers, incredible vocations like that, public health things and things like that, being a good parent, being a good partner, like that. Is this helpful? So I'm going to stop there. I want to leave it there. But I really hope that this creates some sort of some idea of what's helpful for you at the death time, what you can do. And are there any other questions? Yes.
First of all, thank you very much for the program. And I've been looking into death doula or midwife trainings and workshops, and I was wondering if you had any suggestions into where to look or for those. They vary greatly in length and prices. And I was just wondering for your thoughts on that.
I'm afraid I'm not well versed in those, of what's available. Somebody asked me recently of, you know, what hospice program. I don't know. There's a lot. I knew in San Francisco because I did hospice training there, and I knew it was available at the time, but I'm not aware right now. In this area, I wouldn't know at all if you live in this area.
I'm willing to travel because they're vast and expansive and very so great.
Sure. What I would do is, like we do anything, is I would do research. First, spend a little bit of time. First, finding out online, you can find it all, and then start asking people, and then eventually you'll come out with what are the best programs, and then you have to make a decision on finances, travel, where is it in proximity, and just see what you think is going to fit best in your life based on the outcome, like if it's really, you know, midwifery, and you were like, I want to do be a doula for that, and that, you know, that's this kind of training program, and this one would be good enough to facilitate what I'm doing. And if it's a hospice thing, there's lots of hospice volunteer trainings. And the one I did was to be an emotional support counselor as opposed to practical support. Practical support was vacuuming, going to the grocery store for people, doing their laundry. But then I did the emotional support training, so I was there for them to talk to. And so I'm afraid I don't know specifics. Like that. And people, the dying, want to talk about it. If you're an emotional support counselor, you come in. And I remember one of the guys I was with in San Francisco for 2 years, we were very, very close, and his lover would open the door when I'd arrive, and he says, I'm so glad you're here because Joe wants to talk about death. You know, and then he'd leave. And I'm like, that's why I'm here. You know, it's my job. But and just, the, you know, this one guy I was with that was dying, and he got a coughing jag and dying of AIDS, and then he was in the bathroom coughing, and finally I'm like, Rick, you know, I'm like, are you okay? You know, there was a pause, and I'm like, are you? And then he opens the door and he sticks his head and he goes, no, I have AIDS, you know, and I'm like, all right, wah, wah, you know, that. And so, and then sometimes the one thing I wanted to mention was being there with the pain and the suffering is the hardest thing. I mentioned this before in another class like this. This guy, Rick, was a very dear friend of mine. And in those days with AIDS, when you were dying, was awful. It was an awful way to die. And he was in tremendous pain in the end. And the very last few days, there was no way to kind of alleviate the pain. And so I was over at the house, and I come to the house one day, and his partner just leaves. He's just like, I'm out. And he just runs out of the house. And Rick is screaming in the house, screaming in pain. And so he's in a hospital gown on the edge of this hospital bed with his IV. And he was just screaming. I've never heard screaming like, you know, and I came into the, and you know, and you don't want to go in there. You want to get out. Yeah. Like, you don't want to be near that kind of agony. And so it was really, really hard. And I realized I couldn't leave. There's no way I could leave. And I went into the room. And I said, is there anything I can do for you right now? You know, and he all he could do was, he's like, just shook his head. And I was all clammy. I didn't know what to do. I'd never faced anybody's pain like that, you know. And so I just said, is it okay if I stay in the room? And I said, I'm just going to sit down next to you on the bed. I'm just going to stay here with you. And I said, is it okay if I put my hands on your back? Because a lot of AIDS patients, nobody wanted to touch them anymore. And their skin's all, you know, coming apart. And so I'm just going to stay here. Is that okay? And he said, And I said, okay, I'm just going to stay here. I'm not going to leave. I'm just going to be here. And we sat that way with him screaming for 45 minutes. And it was like the hardest 45 minutes of my life at that time. It was very, very difficult. You know, I was sweating and my mind was like, you know, get me out of here and please make it stop. And the meds weren't working and I didn't know what to do, but I just stayed. I didn't say anything. I just stayed there. And then it changes. Everything changes. So whatever happened, the pain subsided. And I was able to get him back in bed. And he was, you know, and I remember I went to get some water for him, and he grabbed my arm really fiercely. And he's like, thank you for not leaving, you know. Thank you for staying here with me. And that's hard. Once you've done it once, it's easier to do it the next time. You know, it's like I didn't die. I mean, he died. But, I mean, you go past the, you know, you just have to be there sometimes. You just show up. And you show up with more resources of yourself. Get bigger. That. Yes.
Yeah, real quick. The Buddha says you never know the time you're going to die. But what is his perspective on, is your destiny already set? Like, you, no matter what I do in life, there's a certain time that I'm going to die. What is the belief on that?
Right. So there could be some, I think, highly realized beings may be able to see what karmic imprints are there of what's unfolding. But karma is so intricate that it changes. So by doing a purification practice with great intent and doing it with great quality, I think you can remove a life obstacle. And by creating a lot of negativity, it could hasten some conditions that could help you, you know, that you could die more quickly. Or, you know, maybe it's like my teacher giving my friend all of this practice to do that she didn't start, because he must have seen that she, by doing the practice, she could have. So I don't know if it's absolutely destined at this moment. Probably an enlightened being could see that, but they would see all the options. If you do this practice, then this will manifest. If you don't do it, this could happen. If you, you know, there's always many options. Like that. I know I was making tsatsas, you know, these tiles, you know, Buddha images. They're not just tiles, but Buddha images, and it's a practice. It's one of our preliminary practices. Tsatsas, I think it kind of purifies the form element, because it's, you know, a form. And so it's a hard practice to do. You get hydrostone, this plaster, and you're carting heavy bags of plaster, and it's an expensive practice, and making the tiles, it was, you know, really rigorous. I still have a few more to make, and so I put a rib out. I got a whole inflammation on my breastbone. I still have it a little bit now, but not as bad. But it was, you know, out for 8 months, and I had to get treatment, and I had to take this, and, you know, and later I thought, you know, that's okay, because maybe I purified lung cancer or breast cancer. Like, maybe it just manifested like that, because I really did you know, and you end up, instead of having a brain tumor, you have a headache. Like that.
I just wanted to add, you know,
I think one thing that everybody can do when they're with somebody who has lost someone, whether it's a parent or a child or whatever, is that it is very healing for them to tell the story of how they were involved with that person and the dying piece of it. And so sometimes if you're their friend, you're like, oh my gosh, she's told me this story. If she's told me once, she's told me it five times, and it's the same story, you know. And you're like, what? But it is really, really healing. And you'll see people say that they tell the story over and over and over again. And that's part of the healing. And if you're a good friend, you're going to be like, oh, this is a brand new story. You know, oh, yeah, I'm ready to listen. So be patient with that, because that is a definite part of healing, is to tell mm-hmm. the story over and over and over again.
It's definitely one aspect, absolutely like that. And then there's other people that told it so much they don't want to relive it, especially a suicide, like how they found them. And they'll just be like, I don't want to talk about it. No. So at that point, let it go. Yeah. And then maybe later they're going to come back with, I want to talk about it now. There's different phases. But that can be really healing.
Yeah, not to necessarily push them to talk about it, but when they do and you've heard this story, you need to be patient and say, oh, okay.
That's right.
Yeah, I can listen.
That's
sure.
Right.
Yeah.
Can I share a legal piece of information?
I have some experience with my husband dying not too long ago, and I wanted to share it with the group in term, not about his death, but there's a piece of information that was vital that it, people don't know this. Medicare does not accept a power of attorney.
Medicare or
Medicare? Medicare. You have to do their form and only their form, and the person who's doing it has to be the person who has the Medicare. So if someone goes into a coma or something like that, they cannot release and say that you're okay to handle their medical insurance or handle any decisions. And I didn't find this out until it was the absolute worst time. He was already totally unable, and I had all these papers. I had every paper you're talking about.
So he wasn't signed up for Medicare, is what you're saying?
No, he had Medicare, but
right.
I couldn't speak with Medicare on his behalf.
Huh. Okay.
I couldn't handle...
Because I've called them for my dad, and I've talked to them.
Without his having given permission verbally?
Mm-hmm.
And without,
no, he's given permission, or he's...
Well, that's what I mean. You have to do it while they're able
to... And they don't...
To,
I thought they have a power of attorney from me, that they
no.
talk to me before.
Well, they do. They have their own form. That's my... My
yeah,
point
to
is
do their form.
You have
to
do
their
form.
Yes,
but
thank you.
But you think you have a
thank
power
you.
Of attorney. It works everywhere. It doesn't.
Thank you. That's
okay.
right. No, and that's what I, sorry, and thank you for
sure.
clarifying. What I meant is when you contact these agencies, they sometimes have their own power of attorney that you have to submit. You can't
that's
just submit. So make sure that it's either yours or the thing or, you know, and get the right one
right.
that it's in there.
You have to go to
and,
a judge to get it.
Yes. Yeah. That's right. And you don't want to hassle with that. Thank
no.
you. Thank you. Liz.
And just to piggyback on that, get it notarized. Whatever state they're in, do it by their state laws. Because I used to work with an estate
yep.
planning attorney, and boy, do it the right way. My question is, my father is dying. He's in New Hampshire. Obviously, I'm not. he's not a Buddhist. I am. What kind of... It feels like a lot of these practices could be... More for me, I don't know if there's, if you can do practices for someone else who's not a Buddhist. I mean, mm-hmm. it's not like I'm going to go and tell them.
Right.
I mean,
yep.
So, you know, I realize that practices ultimately are for your own mind, but with this logistics and situation and everything, I mean, I'm not going to be sitting there
I
with
would,
him.
You know what I would do for him? And Rinpoche's given me some practices for my dad. My dad was a little bit... You know, the person closest with you, you're a little ornery with. So he was kind of taking it all out on me for a few years, and I got really tired of it. And it was a little stressful because we always got along, and I didn't want it to kind of sail out this way, you know. But then he's moved to this assisted living place, and I talked to Rinpoche in September at Light of the Path, and then Rinpoche's giving me a practice and how to dedicate for my father, and I started to do it that day. And the whole dynamics changed immediately with my father, of how he treats me. It was just amazing. So one thing I think that's really helpful is Om Mani Padme Hum, Buddha of Compassion mantra. And if you can say it, imagining the light coming into your father from the Buddha of Compassion, and dedicate, can he always meet the Mahayana teachings, the Lama Tsongkhapa, in every life so that he can get enlightened and be a benefit to all other beings, and then he can be peaceful and his mind peaceful and his body and mind completely free of suffering, and do like a mala every day directed towards him, dedicated like that. You could try that. I think really helpful. So you can definitely do practices, medicine Buddha practice, visualizing the medicine Buddha over him. You can say the mantras. Really helpful.
Thank you.
Yeah. So one last question. How's that? Thank you. Julia?
Sorry. I don't really have a question, but rather a comment, and it's just to reiterate what you said about holding the space for people that aren't Buddhist. And what it takes me back to a memory, my mother died in the 80s, and I was like, oh, my God, she has to listen to Stephen Levine. She has to listen Levine and Halpern. And so I would play those cassettes for her. And then I, you know, as she got sicker, and she was like, why do you keep paying that soap opera music? And so I just want to reiterate how important it is for us not to push our concepts of what that person should be experiencing and to
Thank you.
Hold the space for them. And it's not about our dying. It's about cultivating compassion for that person that is going through that experience.
That's right.
Very,
absolutely.
It's very difficult when it is your mother, you know, because you just think, well, I know what's best for her. But it's so important for us to realize
yep.
that we do not.
Yeah, absolutely. Not. And I know even if they're not Buddhists, like with my grandmother, she was dying and she was in a coma, but I was talking in her ear of all the happy times we've had, all the happy memories, what a great grandmother she's been. And then she loved like waltz music. You know, so I had a thing next to her and I'd play. So I thought at least if she hears that, it could poke a good memory of something she liked and things like that. Thank you very much. We are out of time. I'm sorry it went over a bit, but I want to thank all of you so much for your great effort, and thank you for coming. I'd like to dedicate in the Gold Prayer Book, whatever positive energy we've created. I'm also looking in this prayer book. I want to see what dedications. I can't remember what Rinpoche has. This book is great. It has it all. 235, page 235. I'd like to dedicate all the positive energy we've created from doing this practice together and from spending the weekend like this, that we can really invigorate our practices. Are people, just in general, I want to ask, a little less fear right now about dying? I mean, it does, you start looking at it and you go, okay, all right, this is going to be a big situation, but I think I can start to maneuver. And may we invigorate our practices so that we can have, that we are ready at the death time without regrets and can have peaceful deaths and can help others who are passing away and their loved ones. May it also help us reach this state of full awakening, being a highly, fully realized being and fully enlightened being, a Buddha, so we can benefit all living beings. Page 235. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow. May that which has arisen not diminish, but increase more and more. Just as the brave Manjushri and Samantabhadra too realize things as they are, to dedicate all these merits in the best way, that I may follow their perfect example. Page 244. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All-powerful Chenrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjunath's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplished magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. Thank you very much. I want to thank all the people responsible for my being here, Donna and Jill and Robbie, who's not here, but all the volunteers. You've been amazing. Thank you so much for all your incredible pampering and for the kind hosts. And so come to Laudo. Anyway, thank you very, very much.